Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we'll get reactions to the newly unveiled Senate health care bill, including opposition from a Utah senator. Utah alcohol policy is once again in the spotlight as lawmakers consider tweaks to the law that lowered the DUI threshold. The town of Torrey has some issues with its water supply. The latest in the special election to replace Representative Jason Chaffetz, plus a request by the state to expedite the Lake Powell pipeline and more. Joining us for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune environment reporter Emma Penrod is with us. Good morning, Emma.
Morning.
Also, Salt Lake Tribune food and alcohol reporter Kathy Stevenson, welcome to you.
Good morning. Hello, thank you for having me.
Dan Harry, who is government editor with Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you, Dan, for being
here
as
well. Good morning.
And Salt Lake Tribune columnist George Pyle, editorial writer. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Is it editorial writer or columnist?
Well, technically I'm editorial page editor, which means I get to do more work.
Okay.
And I get a cushy title.
Okay, I'm glad we got it clarified. We also want to hear from you, our listeners, during this Friday morning news wrap-up. You can weigh in on the stories that we're covering today and post your questions at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or call us at 801-355-8255. Again, that's 801-355-TALK. To begin with today, let's do something a little bit different and check in on the ever-fascinating world of alcohol policy in Utah. And Kathy Stevenson, Utah's legislature passed and Governor Gary Herbert signed into law a bill that gives Utah the lowest DUI threshold in the nation. There was pushback at the time that the bill was being considered, a resurgence of that pushback this week during an interim meeting of the legislature's Transportation Committee.
Yeah.
What happened during this meeting?
Well, lawmakers wanted the committee meeting to be about unintended consequences. You know, what did we not think about when we passed the law that maybe needs to be fixed before it goes into effect in 2018, December 30th, 2000. So it's not in effect now.
Right.
They have like a year and a half. Of course, people came up from the hospitality industry, restaurants, and really it became, you know, they don't like the law and they'd like it repealed. But it's not going to happen. It was pretty clear that lawmakers are happy with that law, but they are willing to tweak it if there's something that needs to be done. They were looking at tourism,
right,
which they don't really buy. I don't think that, you know, Utah has lots of tourism, and we've always had quirky liquor laws, so.
But they may be getting quirkier. You spoke, or there was, I guess, Sarah Longwell, who was with the American Beverage Institute, doesn't support this change, and she's part of a campaign. She's been campaigning. Her group has been the most maybe visible around a campaign to try and get this law undone.
And I think that's where the most contention came from lawmakers. I don't think they like somebody from out of the state coming and telling them how to fix their laws. Mm-hmm. I think that definitely showed, I think, during the committee meeting. You know, she claimed there was no statistics that would, you know, save lives, and they didn't use accurate data, and lawmakers weren't really buying that.
Hmm. I want to hear from listeners. If you're interested in joining this conversation, again, 801-355-8255, or comment at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. You also spoke with people involved, as you said, in tourism in Utah, a wedding planner involved in the Salt Lake area convention.
Mary Kraft Homer. She runs a craft catering, and she just said, you know, she's been hearing from people who have booked catering events, brides. You know, they hear about the law from out of state, and they call and say, "What does this mean for my wedding?" And she says, you know, she walks them off the ledge and says, "No, it's going to be fine. You know, you have your party at the hotel, and they're not going to drive. You don't have to worry." But she says, you know, it's the perception. People read about it out of state, and you know, they just think Utah. They don't, you know, it's crazy a little bit. So perception is everything, I think, to the tourism industry.
One fear is that this will affect insurance premiums for bars and restaurants and their employees. We're talking about liability insurance?
Liability. It's quite expensive to have to own a bar because you have to have liability insurance. It's just like your car insurance. If you get in an accident, you go to the insurance company and they work out the deal with the victim. Same with if you serve alcohol to somebody and they go out and get in an accident, you have insurance that covers your bar so you don't go bankrupt.
Hmm.
But maybe the premiums would go up. The insurance industry that was there said it's too early to tell because premiums are based on claims. And so since there haven't been any claims, they don't really know what that would
Hard to foresee the future. The sponsor of the bill, Norm Thurston, he says that that aspect of it, liability insurance, is something that they are willing to maybe address. Or also another tweak to the law that they might want to make is how field sobriety tests are conducted.
Yes. In the inner meeting the other day, it was clear that, you know, a defense attorney says, you know, they test when you do your field sobriety test, they'll do a breathalyzer. And UHP says, no, we don't. You have to go to the lab. But so there was a little bit of debate about, even though when it's done at the site, you know, outside of your car, it's not admissible in court. It's still done. And so there was a little bit of debate about that. And I think Representative Thurston thought that maybe it was good to talk about, maybe we need to standardize things. Maybe they do something different in Salt Lake than they do in St. George. And maybe there needs to be some consistency with this law. So I think they're willing to talk about that.
Well, I want to bring in George Pyle on this from the editorial desk. And now I can't remember what we decided on your title as, George. But
just George. That's fine.
George, perfect. The intent here is essentially to stop anyone who's had anything to drink whatsoever from driving. And that is displeasing maybe to the glass of wine with dinner crowd.
Yeah. I mean, people on both sides throw around the ever useful sentence that begins, studies show. And I haven't read too many of these, and they're precious few links on any of these when they talk about it. But you'll have one person who will say, one drink, especially maybe in a woman who's not very heavy, because weight is a factor in how quickly your blood alcohol level goes up. One glass of wine, one beer, one mixed drink can put you over the limit. And other people say, no, you'd have to drink more than that. And so, you know, we even had a little experiment down at the at the Tribune. And, you know, how fast do you get drunk? How much does it take? And, of course, different people react differently. And some people, because I went from a teetotaler to a beer snob literally overnight when I was 40. So I don't know that and so maybe I'd tolerate it differently than somebody who's been pounding it since he was 18.
Right.
So people react differently. And then there's a question of, you know, are you going to be randomly tested and found to be over this new limit? Or are we never going to look at you unless you swerve out of your lane or have an accident or something like that? If they don't look at you until you've given the police cause to think you're impaired, then this probably won't make much difference. But if they're going to have sobriety check lanes and things like that, which a lot of people think is sort of borderline unconstitutional anyway, then it becomes a different matter.
All right. Well, the sort of question here, I mean, the flip side of this is that, yeah, drunk drivers kill. The question is about whether that data is accurate. Does the difference between 0.05 versus 0.07 is that change in law going to make a difference for anybody who's, you know, going to get behind a wheel when they are intoxicated? Are they thinking of that distinction, I guess?
I think the highway patrolman that were in that committee meeting said, we're not going to do anything different, right? They target you. If you're at a bar and they see you drive away from a bar, they're probably going to stop you if you don't signal, if your taillight is out. I mean, they have a reason to stop you for some other reason, and then they might do that. So one of the somebody in there said that, Dave Morris with Piper Down said he hires people to drive people home. So he says, I have two guys. People don't want to leave their car, so he'll have one guy drive the person in their car home, and then the other guy brings them back. And he says the drivers have been stopped numerous times from police officers.
Wow.
Because they see him drive away from a bar, and they're like, I'm the designated driver.
Is that a change that he's enacted since this
no,
law?
No, he's done it for a while.
Okay.
So, you know, I think people should maybe, you know, I think that's the point of the law. Representative Thurston said, I want people to think twice. I want people to plan ahead. If you're going to drink, make sure you know how you're going to get home.
Okay. Well, we're not quite done talking about alcohol yet, Kathy, because another story that you covered this past week and it has to do with the 3.2% beer that is sold in Utah grocery stores. There are other states that also have the lower alcohol content beer. Actually, Kathy, how many other states require 3.2% beer?
Right now, there's five.
Okay.
That are like Utah and have 3.2 beer in the grocery stores.
Okay.
But that's going away.
Right, it's shrinking. The number is shrinking, and you said that three states in your article are actually doing away with this limit.
In the next 2 years, the major one is Oklahoma. They have 50% of the 3.2 beer. Market, and in the next year they're going to do away with that. They're going to allow higher alcohol into the grocery stores. So, and then Colorado and Kansas.
And that will change the economics of producing the lower point beer, which could spell an end to the available product or product that is legal here in Utah under Utah law in grocery stores.
I think people don't know what will happen, but initially I thought, well, they'll still keep making it, you know. But when I talked to Sal Petalos, the executive director with the DABC, he says, well, if you just look at economics, why would you make something that would only be, it would be a specialty product? Like when it's just Minnesota and Utah,
right.
It'll only be like 0.5% of all the beer.
Which might make it more expensive.
Yes, it might make it more expensive. They might still make it, but it'll be more expensive. There won't be as much variety. It might be difficult to ship in.
You reported that Utah breweries suggested they could conceivably fill the void. Could they support that amount of beer production?
And Sal said possibly, but 3.2 beer in Utah is 94% of all the beer that is consumed in Utah. And so he says 32 million gallons. So he's like, it's a lot of beer to make up. So how could they do that? He's not sure.
If that change were to happen, if 3.2% beer was not available anymore, and Utah grocery stores therefore weren't allowed to sell the beer that was being produced because it was too high of alcohol content, people would still want to be drinking beer, and they'd want essentially more of it than the state liquor stores can handle in volume. Is that correct?
Kind of the discussion at another interim committee meeting on Tuesday. Could the DABC bring in that higher alcohol beer from Anheuser-Busch and MillerCoors? Could they handle the And basically, no. I mean, if you've been reading about the DABC, they can't handle what's here. They don't have the space. They don't have the employees. And so bringing on this huge chunk of alcohol is impossible, they said. They don't have the warehouse space. You know, they wouldn't be able to deliver it. just said it would kind of be logistically impossible.
So there's some rumblings among lawmakers about, you know, moving us off, at least at the grocery store level, off of the 3.2% stuff.
Yes.
And this was during this this Business and Labor Interim Committee meeting. Full-strength beer, therefore, could be coming to Utah grocery stores?
The Manufacturers Association and the grocery stores and the convenience stores say, really, you could solve this problem fairly easily by just changing the limit from 3.2% to like 4.8, 4.5, which is the national standard. You don't really get that much more alcohol when you go to Wyoming and buy a Bud Light than you do in Utah. It's like 1%. Mm. So if you just kind of standardize it, made it standard to the national, you would solve this, because then grocery stores could still sell the same beer that Bud and Anheuser, everybody's selling. So you could do it if the lawmakers were willing to change the minimum.
George Pyle, this is kind of the polar opposite. You described yourself as a beer snob, a former teetotaler, now beer snob. This is kind of the opposite of the story we were just discussing. Yeah. Shifting alcohol content up, even when the DUI threshold is going down. This is economics talking here. Maybe do you see this actually happening in Utah?
Well, I think it's possible. I mean, especially if they are able to stick by their guns in the lower blood alcohol content that we were just talking about, they might be in a mood to kind of make a compromise back the other way to the drinkers and the distributors, and say, and like Kathy said, we're not talking about 8% beer. We're talking about 4.2, 4.8,
yes,
something like
yes.
that. It's not that different. It's the national standard. It would require the legislature of Utah to admit that Utah is part of the United States, which might make them have to grit their teeth a little bit, but it's the fact. It's not that different. Now, I've always kind of thought that selling beer in a convenience store that also has gas pumps kind of sends a bad signal of mixing the two. But, that ship has sailed. So.
All right. Well,
Dan Harris. And I don't like to make predictions. I never predict the outcome of elections. I will make this prediction. the legislature will never allow that higher concentration beer in grocery stores and convenience stores.
All right.
I've covered the legislature since 86. That's not going to happen.
No. I like
can
it.
Just
you,
tell you that.
You heard it here from Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry, alcohol stories in Utah. And actually, there's one more that I want to get to, but first we do need to get to a break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us. There's a lot more to come.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune food and alcohol reporter Kathy Stevenson, environment reporter Emma Penrod, columnist George Pyle, and government editor Dan Harry. We're discussing this past week's local news, and we welcome your questions and comments at either sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or call us up at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. And before the break, we were talking about the DUI law and the alcohol content of store-bought beer. And Kathy Stevenson, just to close out our conversation about all things alcohol, you wrote yesterday a story, it's a Salt Lake City-specific story, a request to move one particular liquor store. Which store is this and who wants it moved?
Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams has sent a letter to the DABC requesting that they relocate the liquor store on 2nd West and 4th South.
Okay.
Not far from Pioneer Park, in the downtown area that's kind of struggling with the homeless problem. That's what they're saying. If you relocate it, it will help as one element of their kind of combating homelessness.
Is there a line that the mayor is drawing between crime among the homeless population downtown and this liquor store? I mean, how does he draw that line?
I think they feel like it's easily accessible. And so if you make it less accessible, maybe that will kind of deter people.
Okay. The DABC says that if they were to close down the store or move the store, they'd have to have another store ready to open downtown somewhere. And, you know, I'm wondering if that's – if what we're really talking about here is sort of a redevelopment project, because I'll admit that driving by that liquor store, it's not the most aesthetically pleasing liquor store on earth.
It's called Store Number One because it was one of the very first liquor stores. I guess there was some reform. You used to have to go like to a window and write your little liquor request and somebody to go in a back room. But once they started doing stores, this was like one of the first ones. And it's small. It's only 8,000 square feet, and it doesn't have a great selection, and it has the tiniest parking lot. If anybody's tried to park, you know it's difficult.
It's kind of a sobriety test. If you can't park there, you shouldn't buy any alcohol.
And I don't think that – I think the DABC would like a new store. I don't think they're opposed to moving it. But they say that that store is the eighth – has the eighth highest sales of all 45 stores. So they don't want to close it and then, you know, wait around for a few years. They want – you know, if they close that one, they want to open a new one.
Part of the reason that I asked the question about, you know, it being a sort of redevelopment project is that – is, you know, why wouldn't the – the problem homeless population that maybe is abusing alcohol or causing crime, why wouldn't they just go to the other downtown liquor store that they're going to open?
Well, and I think that's the question, right? Does moving liquor really solve that problem? I'm not really sure it does, right? I mean, people who have alcohol addictions, you know, there's liquor everywhere. They need different kind of help than just moving a liquor store. They need other services. So moving the liquor store, I'm not sure.
Well, it's not, and we're not talking about this in a vacuum.
Yeah, no.
there's also, I mean, this store is open till 10 p.m. The other stores downtown are open till 7 p.m. That's just one part of the reason why that store gets as much traffic
store,
as it does.
And I always say I love that store because it shows the broad spectrum of socioeconomics in Salt Lake. That you'll see businessmen drive up in their BMW and get, you know, wine. You'll see a homeless person in with a shopping cart. I mean, and everybody in between. And so it kind of represents what all the people who live and work in Salt Lake that you know.
Is anything going to come of this request to move the store?
I am not sure. The DABC commission meeting is Tuesday, the next monthly meeting. It's not on the agenda officially, but if commissioners decide to talk about it, they might.
It could happen.
It could happen.
All right. Well, we shall see. Kathy Stevenson, I'm sure you will keep us apprised. And maybe we should move on to something less intoxicating. Dan Harry, government editor with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks again for being here. Let's move into some politics stories. GOP senators unveiled their plan for health care yesterday. And it's impossible to summarize quickly, but some key elements include capping and reducing Medicaid. In fact, Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act will be phased out altogether over time. Pre-existing conditions will still have to be covered, but states could ask for a reduction in the so-called essential health benefits that are currently required to be covered under the law, and that could conceivably price people with pre-existing conditions out. There's a repeal of taxes on wealthy Americans and corporations in this, taxes that were used to pay for Obamacare. And then there are subsidies provided to buy insurance, assuming this law passes. But those subsidies would appear to mean lesser quality plans for poorer Americans. Dan, it's a draft bill. Changes are sure to occur, but the process through which this bill was brought forward, that process elicited some criticism from Democrats and from a prominent Utah Republican, and he's still not happy. Tell us about this. This is Senator Mike Lee, along with some of his Republican colleagues in the Senate who are not on board with this.
Right. Well, it elicited criticisms, and well, it should, because it was put together in secret, and the folks putting it together apparently were a very small circle, because Senator Mike Lee from Utah was supposed to be on the drafting panel and said he hadn't seen the bill. He didn't know what was in it. So that shows you how close to the vest they were holding it. And, you know, McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has expressed interest in having a vote by next week. You know, this is the same criticism that you heard from Republicans on Obamacare, that they were trying to rush it through.
Well, from Mitch McConnell specifically. I mean,
yeah. And if you compare the timelines there, there's no comparison. There was a lot more time to talk about Obamacare. There were public hearings on it. And the Democrats actually tried to, you know, sway a few Republicans because they knew it would look bad if they passed a plan that had only Democratic votes. They ended up with only Democratic votes. But they did make an attempt to get some Republican support, came close to getting some moderate Republican support. Didn't happen. But, you know, you're guaranteed that you're not going to get any Democratic support on this, despite the president saying the Democrats need to come aboard and Mitch McConnell saying that and Orrin Hatch saying that. But even Mike Lee says right now he's going to oppose this bill. He's not going to oppose it for the same reason Democrats are.
Almost
he's
going for the opposite.
Exactly. Yeah. He says it doesn't do enough to wipe out the legacy of Obamacare and do away with some of the programs he is opposed to. And he's joined by, you know, three other Republican senators that if they hold their stance on this, that bill's not going to pass the Senate.
Okay. So if Lee and his cohort don't get brought around, this is dead on arrival.
Right. And, you know, this is the opening gambit of them trying to change, conservative up the bill, you know, to get changes that they want. But, you know, we've seen in the past with Mike Lee, you know, he's willing to go to great lengths to get what he wants. And, you know, it's hard to say this is a bluff.
The president also had sort of a lukewarm response, a guarded endorsement of the bill. Senator Hatch, as you said, praised the bill essentially to a certain extent.
Yeah, Hatch is on board, as he is with everything, you know, Republican and Trump. So that was no surprise there.
He called it a discussion draft, as did the president, again, pointing to probable or possible changes in the bill. How drastic of changes could we see?
Well, we don't know yet. And, you know, the Congressional Budget Office hasn't scored this bill yet. So, you know, we're hoping that that comes out and tells us exactly what the impacts will be as far as they can predict. And the House side, you know, that bill that the House passed, it said 23 million fewer Americans would have health care coverage. And so that's what people want to know about this bill. How many more people will be thrown off the insurance coverage.
Well, the president called that draft proposal mean. There was some swift...
After praising it as a great plan.
Right. There was some swift opposition from policy and healthcare groups here in Utah to the unveiling of this bill. Can you tell us about that, as the bill is proposed currently?
Yeah, they're warning, as you would expect, that, you know, this is going to mean fewer people are insured, and it's going to hit the people at the lower end of the economic scale much harder. It's going to actually help people at the upper end of the scale. And they're questioning, again, sort of the transfer of wealth from people who don't have any money to those who do have it.
Hmm. Dan, one thing we haven't brought up yet is a provision in this this draft bill pertaining to Planned Parenthood. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So under the provisions of the bill, as I understand it, women would no longer be able to, you know, get any services through Planned Parenthood and have it covered by this expanded Medicaid and through the health care bill that they would be subsidizing.
George Pyle, the name of the game here is repeal and replace. It's a campaign promise that is coming to fruition. Instead of getting into the weeds here, maybe I'll ask for a more general take on maybe not the bill itself, but what should be done about American health care. George, give us an answer.
Well, okay. Well, yeah, if I could explain that to you, I'd
it's complicated.
I wouldn't be here today. But for one thing, I don't think it's really fair. We're all calling this a health care bill. This isn't a health care bill. This is a tax cut bill. The point of this is to cut taxes on the rich and sort of kind of later pay for those tax cuts by cutting back on subsidies and by cutting back on Medicaid. Not just Medicaid expansion. They're not just trying to repeal the Great Society. They're trying to repeal the New Deal. And, you know, Paul Ryan is on record. He says that when he was in college drinking beer, his great childhood fantasy was to block grant Medicaid. He wanted to be the first person in American history to roll back an entitlement.
Right.
He thinks that's a lot of fun. And other people think that's, like me, think that's just disgraceful. But there's all these videos of him. The HuffPost has posted several of them.
Well, that was in college.
He's still talking about, there's still things where he's saying today that his goal is to be the first politician in American history to roll back an entitlement. And the reason that the stated reason that the Utah legislature wouldn't expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act was they were saying, well, what happens if we expand Medicaid and then later they take it back? What do we either have to pick up the cost ourselves, which we can't, or we have to roll back a benefit that we've given, which is extremely unpopular and, you know, just not very nice. Mm-hmm. And the argument to that was, we've never rolled back an entitlement. We haven't rolled back Social Security. We haven't rolled back Medicaid. We haven't rolled back Medicare. Don't worry. This will always be here. Well, now we're finding out maybe it won't. Now, the other fact is—
It hasn't happened yet.
It hasn't happened yet. And what's likely to happen probably is that because the bill isn't draconian enough for Mike Lee and Rand Paul, that it won't pass. If they try and go more in that direction, they'll probably lose like Susan Collins and a couple other moderate Republicans, and then it won't pass either. What they'll probably continue to try and do is just nickel and dime it to death, not keep up with the subsidies, let it collapse here, don't bail out this insurance plan over there, and make a self-fulfilling prophecy of what they've been saying, that Obamacare is already in a death spiral. Well, where it in the states and counties where it's not functioning, it's because the Republicans in Congress have deliberately sabotaged it. I mean, that's just objectively true. They have deliberately sabotaged this, hoping that it will all go away. So they may be able to kill it without their fingerprints being on it.
Is that all politics? Is that competing, you know, worldviews?
I think it is. I think the Republican Party right now is dominated by people who, as my father used to say, think that the problem with America is that poor people have too much money and rich people have too little. This is the biggest income transfer from the poor to the rich in American history. And it is the point of this, a huge income transfer from the poor to the rich. That's their goal. They don't care about health care one way or another.
Again, George Pyle from the editorial desk at the Salt Lake Tribune. And, you know, there's currently a vote scheduled on this bill for sometime next week.
Thursday
of next week. But right now, a lot of work has to be done to convince enough people to get it to pass. I'm assuming
it would be surprising, I think, right now if they held that vote on Thursday. But we'll see.
But bills like this that start in the Senate, I mean, they have a much better go in the House if they do get through the Senate. I mean, that's
well. The House has its own version,
right.
So if this, So if this does pass, there are going to be differences, and they would have to be reconciled.
And even with we hear from the White House supportive noises. We hear that he's called it mean. We hear people bringing up
called
the House version mean, and plus people are dredging up tweets from way back in the primaries where Trump was saying, don't worry, I won't cut Medicare, I won't cut Medicaid, I won't cut Social Security. I will just do it differently in a way that's better.
Not only that, he said he wanted to cover make sure all Americans had health care, they had affordable health care.
Yeah. He just said he could do it better than Obamacare. Right. He never explained how. But anybody who voted for him based on that promise— Congress is trying to do exactly the opposite.
And I think that's the problem for Republicans in Congress right now is, and as with the House, they felt like they were on the same team with President Trump. So they passed this bill and he was pushing for that bill, called it a great plan. And then a few weeks later, he calls it a mean bill. He attacks it. So if you're a Senate Republican and you're thinking, all right, I'm going to do this because the president supports it and we're all on the same team.
You don't know what's
going on. I want his help in my reelection. You don't know. You can't trust that he's going to stick with you. I mean,
somebody
read it to him
at some point, and all of a sudden he realized it wasn't what he'd promised in the campaign.
Well, some version of it. Guys, we will see where this process leads. But I'm sorry to cut us off right now, but we do have to take a quick break and then head to some more stories. But we will be back with more from this past week's news. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. And if you're listening on KCPW, just a quick plug about supporting the station and keeping programs like Behind the Headlines going. If you enjoy this or any of our other local programs, please consider helping us meet our goal. Thank you. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Emma Penrod, Dan Harry, Kathy Stevenson, and George Pyle. Chime in with your comments and questions during this Friday morning news roundup by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. We're going to bring in Tribune environment reporter Emma Penrod now. Emma, good morning.
Good morning.
You reported this week on some trials and tribulations for the town of Torrey. I did not mean for that to be as alliterative as it was. What happened in Torrey?
Well, I guess the short way of putting it is the town ran out of water. Now, that does not mean that they ran out of water because, as some people have said, it's a desert town and they should have expected that because there's no water in Utah. That's not what happened. It was an infrastructure problem. There was a break in this 15-mile pipeline that takes water from a spring over to the town's main water system. While that was broken, there wasn't any water going into, or there wasn't as much water as usual going into the town system itself. It was over a weekend. Apparently, a lot of people came into town, tourists, part-time residents, visitors, and they actually managed to drain a very large quantity of their storage, their water storage, and the loss of water pressure then made it so that the water couldn't be distributed throughout the system, and about half the town ended up with no water or unreliable water service coming out of their taps.
So the town, essentially running out of water, a state of emergency was declared, and so trucks had to come in with water to replenish to some extent the water that was there, but that was a temporary solution as well. Water was drawn down from that as well. And that can lead to potential health issues. There are, there was a boil order in effect, I believe.
Yeah, because part of what happened was as they realized that the tanks were drawn down and they didn't have enough water to keep the town going, and that they asked people to stop watering, to try to use water more judiciously. They say that didn't happen. And so ultimately what they tried to do was they tried to shut the water system off completely overnight to try to give it they fixed the water leak, or at least the initial leak, relatively quickly. Hmm. And then they just needed those tanks to refill because they had been drawn down. So they shut the water system off overnight to try to give them a chance to refill. And that didn't ultimately work either. But because the system was shut down, there's a potential for contamination to be introduced into the water system every time it shut down. Hmm. So they had to have to go through this procedure that involves not allowing anyone to drink the water until it's confirmed safe.
The timing here is a little bit interesting because the town has been looking to upgrade its water system and recently requested funding from the state to help with that.
And they did actually get a fair amount of funding to replace that 15-mile pipeline. It's a 6-inch pipe right now. They want to upgrade it and put in a new 10-inch pipe that would allow more water to come from the spring down to the town system, which would, in theory, if this happened again, allow the tanks to fill faster. Hmm. And so that's what that money would go toward. They have, if I understand, a $500,000 grant and then a $1.7 million loan that they're going to be combining to get that project done.
Okay, 15 miles of pipe between the spring and town and replacing that. There was this funding request, and just a kind of side note that's interesting is that maybe, I don't know, a couple of weeks back, Representative Mike Noel from Kanab, is that where he's from?
I believe so.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sorry, thank you. He made a kind of snide remark about the town of Torrey. Tell us about that remark that he made.
Yeah, well, that was an interim meeting. They were discussing the budget for some of the water-related divisions in the state of Utah. And he went on to say that he felt some people who were requesting funding from the state for water were hypocrites in that they wanted sources of funding that were... some of the money came from oil and gas and other mining related industries, and he felt that there were elements in the town of Torrey that did not support these industries, and therefore he said it was hypocritical for them to want money from those industries but not to want those industries in their town. There was apparently a feud over the location of a gravel pit near that town.
Okay.
That was the catalyst for that.
Does the town, sorry, just jumping back to the story, the original story, does the town now, does it have water again? Is it running water?
Yes, everything was worked out just a couple days ago. I understand most water service resumed. I think it was Tuesday. Boil order was initially lifted Wednesday night, I believe, for most of the town. There was still some that lingered a little while because it was the last to get water service. I think they, about midday Wednesday was when their water service was restored. So,
keeping tourists happy, we're heading to Torrey for the weekend, maybe. You spoke with the town's mayor. This is Scott mm-hmm. Chestnut about all of these issues. And Emma, he sounds like kind of a character. He talked about the terrain that pipe from the spring to the town traverses, that 15-mile course of terrain that it goes being extremely rough. And he says that, you know, no matter what, it's going to essentially keep breaking. And I'm just going to give you his quote. He said, "There's not a lot you can do about it. When you can start controlling God and Mother Nature, maybe then you can keep the water." Amazing, amazing quote from the guy. So, Torrey's not out of the woods in his mind.
Yeah, the pipeline runs through a canyon that is prone to flash flooding, and it was in fact damaged, I understand, in the area of the last break last year during a flash flood in 2016, and that was repaired. It was intended to be a temporary repair that then, you know, later, I guess, contributed to this leak that caused this whole situation or, you know, set it off. So, and I mean, in his mind, that pipe is in the canyon. There's, you know, going to be flooding in the canyon. He said it's been a habitual issue, the canyon flooding and damaging the pipeline since it was put in the 1960s. So in his mind, this is just a natural consequence of the location of the pipeline.
Hmm. Well, troubles for Torrey and conceivably eternal troubles, if you believe the mayor there. We don't have a lot of time left, guys, on the show, and I don't want to end without talking about something that I said we would talk about at the outset, which is the special election to replace outgoing Representative Jason Chaffetz, who's retiring in a week's time. Dan Harry, you know, maybe just in the interest of time, I'll ask for kind of an overview on this. There were conventions last weekend. We now have a smaller field of candidates vying to replace him. The Democrats have chosen
Kathy Allen.
Kathy Allen, thank you. And on the Republican side, well, things are a little bit more complicated.
Chris Herrod is the preferred candidate from the Republican convention. Very conservative former legislator, kind of made his mark in being a fierce opponent of illegal immigration and wanted Utah to have laws like Arizona's, you know, check your papers and have local police acting as agents to arrest illegal immigrants. So that's kind of where his background is. But because the governor has forced the issue here and allowed signature gathering, there will be two other Republican right. candidates on the primary, and that's Provo Mayor John Curtis and Tanner Ainge, who's the son of former BYU basketball player and now Boston Celtics general manager Danny Ainge. And so it'll be a three-way race. And so for Republicans,
as a primary,
on August 15th, that will be a pretty attractive election to participate in. You got a wide array of choices there.
You know, is the favorite, though, just, I mean, I'm thinking about this, not that you want to pick favorites. You've made one prediction on the show.
Yeah,
already.
I don't make predictions about elections now.
But given the fact that Chris Herrod got his nod from, got the nod from his party in this convention, does that give him a sort of leg up?
I don't know if it does. You know, it depends on turnout, I think, a lot. If it's a big turnout, I think that maybe favors, I would guess at this point, John Curtis. Hmm. And who's seen as a conservative, but more moderate than Chris Herrod. Tanner Ainge is a total question mark in terms of policy. You know, he hasn't ever held elected office.
He's
never run for elected office. So he says he's a conservative, but what does that mean? We don't really know very much about his policy stance. So, you know, at this point, I'd say it's probably between Herrod and Curtis.
Can I ask also, you know, there was a dispute. In fact, there remains a dispute, Dan, between the governor and the legislature over how this process was occurring. But despite that, the process is still going forward.
Yeah, the legislature is really fuming over this. They are very unhappy that the governor just went ahead unilaterally and set the parameters for this election, set the schedule for it, and didn't call the legislature into special session. They are really mad. They've threatened lawsuits. But they, on the other hand, they don't want to disrupt the special election that's now underway because they know if they do that, it's going to be a long, long time before that Chaffetz seat can be replaced.
And they might, I mean, this is maybe the cynic in me, but they might also might look bad for having delayed that election from a political standpoint.
Yeah, I don't know. It's that so much. I mean, I think they're really upset about this. They believe in separation of powers, and they think it's been violated here. So, but they're not upset enough, I don't think, to sue over it.
George Pyle, does that represent a and you're from the opinion desk again? I gotta give you the caveat. Is that a win for the governor then? I mean, the fact that his process is moving forward.
Well, and just in the sense that he wanted to do this and that's what we're doing, it's a win. Any kind of long-term political benefit or damage, I don't really see much one way or another. It is kind of refreshing to see the departments, the division of power that was set up to run this country and was copied by the states, to have the legislature stand for its prerogatives and the executive stand for their prerogatives and not Republican versus Democrat. Now, maybe that can only happen in a one-party state where there isn't any partisan fight to be had. But to see the legislature say, we're not ceding our power and the power we ought to have, and for the governor to say, look, I'm the governor, I'm the executive, the law is a little vague in some areas, but it says the governor shall call a special election. So I've called one. If they want to change the law come the next regular session, that's their prerogative, and I would imagine they will, just because there's kind of a hole
they will
in this.
Too, yeah.
But they had 120 years to do this. They had a little bit of a flag go up when there was a rumor that Congressman Stewart might go be Secretary of the Air Force or
right.
something, and they would have to fill that seat. But that
bill almost passed. It died toward the end of the session.
No. And but I mean, and then that didn't happen. And he didn't leave Congress, and they didn't have that to fill. I mean, they probably ought to come back and make it very clear how a vacancy will be filled. On top of all of this is the fight over, is it convention caucus system? Is that somehow sacrosanct? Do we want to have the petition route on? And this is kind of the first experiment of how this is going to work. And if the people who say petitions are good because they open up the process, or they say petitions are bad because they bring in people who we have no idea who they are and they just have enough money to hire petition carriers. I mean, there's kind of arguments for both sides in what we're seeing in this particular race.
The fact of the matter is, if you didn't have the signature gathering, Chris Herod would be the Republican nominee right now,
right,
and likely the next congressperson.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And does that really represent all of the congressional district, or does that just represent the 700 people who showed up at that convention? Our argument at the editorial board has always been you do not fill a seat in Congress with the votes of 700 people.
What is the stance, just quickly, or not the stance, but the status of that, the sort of fight over the election law compromise that took place a few years ago, SB 54, that allowed for the signature gathering to go on? Is that still being debated?
Well, yeah.
In fact,
we just have a story up this morning that says that the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver has now scheduled oral arguments for that. And the new party chairman, Rob Anderson, has very mixed feelings about it. Now, he just got elected.
Right.
He has not been a big supporter of continuing this lawsuit, which has now put the Republican Party, it's $500,000 in debt. $300,000 of it is attributed to this lawsuit, the legal cost for this. And this is going to mean, if it continues, that in September, if they go ahead and have oral arguments, that those legal costs are just going to go up and up.
But it sounds like right now going forward, this lawsuit's going forward.
Well, he said he's going to take it to the Central Committee. I think his recommendation would be let's let this thing rest, but they're going to go ahead with it.
All right. Well, guys, we are going to have to leave it there because it is time now for us to turn to our underplayed stories of the week. And you know the drill. Dan Harry, are you ready with an underplayed story?
I think I'll go with the story about the South Salt Lake mayor, Cherie Wood, who for a long time has been accused of kind of padding the city hall payroll with her friends and cronies. And recently, the issue was raised by a couple of city council members that the director of her political PAC that runs her campaigns is a huge contractor with the state, has a contract that is now bringing in about $300,000 a year from the city. And because they raise these issues, that person has now resigned from the PAC but still remains as a contractor with the city.
Hmm. Okay. Dan Harry's pick for underplayed story. How about yourself, Kathy Stevenson?
I'll just pick one that I read yesterday from Brian Mathley about Zion National Park looking for private donations.
Right.
You know, I think that's interesting. There's such a debate about, you know, national parks and Zion's like, we still have stuff we've got to do, so help us out. So
a funding shortfall.
Yeah.
looking for some funding to help get that taken care of. All right, Kathy Stevenson, pick. Emma Penrod, environment reporter, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Well, shameless self-promotion here for me, but this was from last weekend, but still within a week. There is an event held, or that has traditionally been held annually at the Great Salt Lake Marina, called Sail Fest. And it returned this year after taking a little bit of a hiatus due to the low lake levels, but they still weren't able to offer what has always been the key attraction of that event, which is where the members of the yacht club take members of the public who are not boaters out on free sail rides to introduce them to the Great Salt Lake. That couldn't happen this year because the marina is still in the process of being dredged, and so it's difficult to get boats in and out.
What happened this year?
So this year, instead, they invited two local environmental groups to attend a meet and greet and linger with their members. The Yacht Club has become more politically active in the last year or so as their frustration about what's happening with the management of the lake has grown with the low lake levels and feeling like something needs to be done about that. And so for a first time ever, they had a meet and greet with various water advocacy groups among their members instead of free sail rides.
All right, a change for the Salt Lake Great Salt Lake Yacht Club, I guess, Emma Penrod's pick. And George Pyle, underplayed story of the week. Are you ready with one?
Well, this is only underplayed in the sense that there's no way you could overplay it. The new census data that we reported on the other day, Utah, like the rest of America, is becoming less and less white and more everything else. And not just from immigration, from birth rates. And so we're going to have to get used to a multilingual, multicultural, multi-ethnic society. Education will be more difficult. Business will change. Law enforcement will have to adapt to this. But we'll eat better.
Well, some planning needs to be done, and that's great. Okay, George Pyle's pick. I'm going to go with a... I'll go with a traffic heads up to drivers in the Salt Lake Valley. Westbound I-215 is closing for maintenance projects, and it's from the mouth of Parley's Canyon to the I-80 Junction. It's not very big, but it's going to cause big delays. It will reopen Monday morning at 5 a.m. I'm doing this as a public service announcement to anybody who's out driving
just
this
don't
weekend.
Go there.
Yeah, beware, and check the UDOT website for more information. Dan Harry, Emma Penrod, Kathy Stevenson, and George Pyle, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us on Behind the Headlines today.
Have a good one.
Thanks.
That does it for this edition of the show. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, Tom Williams, Spencer Holsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen, who manage the broadcast at Utah Public Radio. Thanks, as always, to the show's producer, Emily Means, too. And for podcasts of this program, you can visit our website, kcpw.org. And a quick reminder to KCPW listeners that we are on air today only for our summer fun drive. We've got, it looks like... $18,000 left in our goal, and you can help with a pledge of support at kcpw.org. Your pledges are what allow this and all of the programs you hear on this station to be here, so please consider doing your part. Again, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. We're glad you could join us today. Have a great weekend.